My name is David Bullen, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
My name is Josh Margolin, and I am on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya, how's it going?
I
went for
okay.
my super morning zoo voice there. Sorry about that.
You did, but you know, it's been a little bit of a week. You know, there's
no.
You know,
what happened?
There was like an election.
I didn't tell you this. I took a nap on Monday, and I haven't been paying. And I just woke up like right to do this. Did I miss anything?
Yeah, you nothing, absolutely nothing. But
oh,
first,
that's a relief.
We should talk about the people who are on the show today. The people on the show today: Josh Margolin and David Bolin, who are the director and DP team behind the movie Thelma, which is one of my favorite movies this year. It is such a great movie, and absolutely everyone should go watch it. It is now on VOD.
Starring the amazing June Squibb, by the way.
June Squibb, who is just spectacular. The movie is a delight. So we're going to get into that interview in just a few minutes with Josh and David. And it's one of my favorite interviews this year. It's so much fun. We get into.
Oh, really? I'm going to call up all the other interviews and tell them that you're
one of my favorites.
So we're not going to rank them.
Come on. Okay. We have too much other important stuff to talk about. So,
and now close focus.
In addition to all of these sort of U.S. politics that were going on this year.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about U.S. politics, but we do have something political to talk about. Oh my God, it's political, and it's about cinematography, which, by the way, makes me not happy to talk about this, but it does make me happy that our close focus is so cinematography centric, because usually we're talking about general entertainment stuff, which is fine, cool, whatever. But this is the real stuff right here.
Oh yeah, this is the real deal. So we got to go back in time a little bit to get into this, but
okay.
Essentially, camera image, which we talked about just a week ago because of the controversy of them deciding to program the movie Rust, Helena Hutchins' last movie, and the backlash. And,
yeah, there's a huge backlash by people, including, you know, the amazing Rachel Morrison, pushing back against them, you know, exploiting their fallen sister cinematographer. And that's important because go on.
It's not that this festival has been without controversy in the past, you know, it's
but it's the only film festival that focuses on cinematography like that I know of in the world, unless we go through with our plan and found one in Burbank.
Yeah, we've talked about it. Also, there's, you know, there is one in Macedonia. So but there's not a lot. So anyway, here's the thing. In August,
Macedonia. Go on.
In August, actually the one in Macedonia, technically we talked about it before, technically the first festival about cinematography, but the camera image has dwarfed it in recent years. It's become much, much larger. And in August 1st this year, Women in Cinematography, a group, published a petition specifically for a call for change at camera image. And we'll put a link in the show notes to that petitions, in case you'd like to join it, and also a bunch of other links so you can follow all of this controversy that we're talking about. Okay, so after this very, very valid petition for change, this sort of calling out of camera image.
So what was the change they were asking for?
They were asking for inclusion. They were asking for, like, hey, look at your history. Look at what you've done over the last 30 years. You know, women have been treated as, you know, basically invisible or non-existent in camera arts for decades and decades and decades. And the change that they are seeking is some awareness and representation, because let's face it. There is tons of good work out there happening, but you actually will have to look for it when you're just in a space that is so dominated by men. You actually have to put some effort into your searches, because it's not like there isn't tons
you're not
of great
saying
stuff
like
being done.
For us, you're saying for a film festival that focuses on cinematography.
Exactly.
They would have to change, because, like, I have found in our 10 years of doing this that there's no shortage of women doing this at the highest levels, doing amazing work. We've talked to a bunch of them.
No, as a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure we've talked to more of them than any other podcast actually out there, because we specifically actually look for that. We look for women who are, you know, doing great work, and we want to talk to them. So
anyway. I just want to say before you even get into it, before you get into the response that was given by the director of camera.
Yeah, because that's where I'm getting next.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, yeah. Like to me, this is a layup. Oh, we messed up. We're gonna change now. What's the big freaking deal? Okay, cool. So tell me how camera image doubled down on misogyny. I just want to hear it.
Okay, so basically they've in the past been given a forum inside of Cinematography World magazine. Not my favorite magazine about cinematography, but they give this forum to Merrick Zydowick, who is the head and founder of Camera Image. It's called From the Top, and it drops on November 8th. And in this, he basically says, women cinematographers are mediocre. And I'm paraphrasing here, so I don't, you know, quote the entire thing, but I think there's a link we can put in the show notes if people want to read it. And he says, like, oh, you know, we just don't have enough space to include women, essentially, is what gets down to. It's really terrible. And then towards the bottom of this, he actually is saying, because we don't have the space, we need more space. You should all be writing to our government to provide us that space. You should be writing in saying how we need this extra space. So, you know, tell the government, tell our sponsors to build this extra expansion for us that we need, which to me, that was really the thing. It was like, not only was they not responding appropriately, and of course, they've now since said that, well, we were misunderstood. Oh, that they didn't respond appropriately. The whole thing was like very thinly veiled to like, we could do better if we had more space. So you should like be writing to our government to get them to give us more space. Okay. So this happens on November 8th, November 9th.
By the way, that's 4 days ago as we're recording this.
Exactly. So just a couple of days ago. So then the BSC immediately comes out with a really strongly worded response, and they should. Cinematography World Magazine is a British based publication. And holy crap, they write a scathing open letter, which the ASC signs onto and a message of support. And then also the same day, Cinematography World Magazine starts distancing itself from the comments of Merrick Zydowick. Mm-hmm. So immediately when this happens, they're like, hey, you know, we're not responsible for this content. We give people a platform. We're of course very, you know, interested in this and in all of this stuff. And so to double down even further, then the founder of Camera Image publishes a response to the BSC.
Oh, no. Oh, no. What did he say? This part I actually don't know. What did he say?
It's a non-apology. He basically says, I'm sorry you misunderstood me. And is like, I'm sorry for your misunderstanding. And like, he's not actually apologizing. And
so I'm sorry for your misunderstanding. And then follows it with, of course, we're inclusive. No, what does he say?
Yes, he makes some comments about their inclusivity, but regardless.
Oh, okay.
But he does.
So
at least he knows
he done fucked up.
Yeah, but he doesn't do it well. He doesn't respond appropriately. And this is actually where it's interesting, and we'll put a link in the show notes so people can go to the Instagram comments, because the comments from this response are great, from all these people saying like, hey, this is not an apology. This is what the hell are you doing? And then following day.
Oh, no.
issues an actual apology. So it took another day of like.
Third time's a charm.
Yes. And I got to say, what's pretty damning is though, and pretty amazing is that the cinematography community rallies together behind, you know, this sort of like shared loathing of just the complete misogynistic statements from Camera Image. As they should. SOC posts a great Instagram carousel of all of these organizations that immediately step up and go like WTF Camera Image, like really saying we stand in solidarity of all these people who called you out. As sort of a conclusion to all of this, Cinematography World Magazine gives women in cinematography a forum to respond to everything that's happened so far and publishes a response. We'll have the link to that as well. And it basically says, your words are empty, and let's look at your actions, Camera Image. You've had two female jury members in the history of your festival. You've had less than like it's 3.1% of all films that you've shown, like, you know, over the years have been shot by women DPs. And then it's like what's really, really galling, I think, to a lot of people is that it's not like this festival has only ever programmed truly the best of the best. There's a lot of stuff there at this festival, which has not been great. So to say that you could not find great stuff shot by women, and then they're showing some other stuff, which there's supposed to be like, you know, the pinnacle, the highest art. Yeah, I don't know. There's a...
I mean, do you actually think... I think the answer is yes, but I'm curious. Do you actually think that this is institutional misogyny where the people running camera image, if Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind could have a spot there, they're like, we like it, but a woman shot it, so no. So
this final piece by Women in Cinematography really calls out how like Mudbound was not in competition. It was a special screening and like none of Ellen Curris's work had been featured. And like, they're basically kind of gone through and was like really kind of called deservedly so, called them out in a way that was like, look, your actions speak way louder than any words that you can say about this. So
I predict there will be a change at the top of camera image within the next few months, probably, you know, like they're going to I think about like at the Los Angeles Independent Film Festival, or I guess it's Los Angeles Film Festival. The guy who ran it for a long time was Mormon and personally had donated to Prop 8, which kept gay marriage illegal in California, and immediately was run out of the festival. I think that if you create controversy around your film festival, you cannot stay there. Like, you're the face of the festival.
Look, they rely on a lot of foreign money coming into this festival. They rely on the fact that large, you know, sponsors, large people come into their country, and the dollar goes a really long way there because their currency is very devalued in comparison. So you can do these really extravagant parties, you can do these really, you know, incredible things, but I don't know what the optics are going to be after this. And frankly, there's not going to be anyone.
Optics, yeah, I get it.
Exactly. I don't think there's going to be, look, it's Poland. Poland is culturally very different than the US. So they're quite conservative and I don't.
But this festival is quite international. This is a big international and festival. Look,
there have been problems. I'll say problems with other events and people in the past that the film industry has kind of, you know, not necessarily completely rejected. So I would be, look, I think there's a lot of things to dislike about camera image.
Cough, 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 Roman Polanski, cough, cough. Anyway,
I think that there's a lot of good reasons not to make camera image the number one cinematography festival in the world. There is a lot of good reasons not to do it. It'll be interesting for me to see which companies really put their money where their mouth is, where they decide, they decide they don't want to do this? Do they think that they're really going to institute change? What's going to happen? Will Merrick step down? He's the founder. I don't know.
I bet he steps down.
Who knows what the response is going to be, but maybe something major will happen. Maybe there'll be a shift in power. Maybe there'll be a new cinematography film festival that becomes the...
In Burbank, run by you.
Look, we joked about this months ago, but you know, if not by me, maybe somebody else, maybe somewhere else in the world, someone will pick up the mantle and decide that they want to do this. Clearly, there is a desire from people to make this happen. So why not? Let's get to the interview with the creative team from Thelma.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Hey, I'm joined now by David Bolin and Josh Margolin, who are the DP director combination of the new movie Thelma, which I loved. Welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is awesome. Happy to be here.
It's a dream.
You know, I shouldn't actually say that this movie is new. I think it debuted at Sundance. So, you know, it's been around and it's been in theaters, and now it's available on streaming, but I don't want to get the streaming service wrong. Tell everyone where they can VOD or watch this online.
So as of now, it's available on, you know, you can rent it or buy it on iTunes and Amazon and all of that. And then it will be streaming on Hulu in November.
All right. Fantastic. Hey, Velma is such a delight. It's such a fun movie. I really enjoyed it. And you know, the number one thing now that I know a little bit more about this, and we'll get into all of this in a second, is that it feels like it is born out of love, Josh, for your grandmother. And I think that is so wonderful. And that is not something that, you know, it's not something you see a lot. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of the project, not from maybe where that project came from, but like, okay, you've got a script, you've got an idea. How is the reception of people? How is the reception of all the other people you've got to get on board to this? Is it kind of like read the script? It's not like anything you've ever read before, or maybe it is like something you've read before, but it's pretty rare. Tell me about the process of you've got the idea, you've written a script. How do you get the buy-in? How do you get the people to say, yes, I want to be involved in this?
That's a, you know, it's a great question, and I'll let David speak to it too. But I think at least from my perspective, I think because it was a personal story and because it was, as you said, written from a place of sort of love and admiration for this person, I would hope that would kind of come through in the script. And, you know, it's a comedy. It also has these kind of action genre elements and kind of caper elements to it. But yeah, at its core, it is kind of a love letter to my grandma Thelma. And I feel like the people who were drawn to it and the team that kind of got built off of it were people who connected to that in some way and connected to that affection or that warmth or that you know, aspiration. And part of it too was, you know, the first people I teamed up with were my producers, Zoe Wirth and Chris Kay, who are really close friends of mine. And we have like a weekly writers group, and I brought the script in there and we read it, and they were very encouraging and gave me great thoughts and feedback and such. And I think they kind of saw it the way I saw it, and they came on board early and became such great champions for it that I think we just had kind of this like very homegrown, tight knit, like well oiled little machine that was kind of pushing the thing along. And I hope that energy combined with the thing itself was what kind of signaled to people that they wanted to jump on board. Because yeah, it's, you know, it kind of self-selects. There's definitely going to be people who were not going to jump on board with this movie, who didn't kind of get what we were going for. And then, you know, there are people like David who did, and thank God.
Yeah. David, let me bring you this in this conversation too. What did you think when you read the script for the first time? What was going through your mind? Like, were you immediately excited?
Yeah, I think for me, the big thing with so many directors is like the why behind the script they're doing. And I think a lot of times when I'm reading a script and I'm interviewing with the director, talking with them, you're kind of like, so why do you want to make this? And a lot of directors, they're like, oh, I don't know. I kind of thought it was like a cool premise. I don't know. It could be fun. Whereas like, you're kind of like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what that means, you know? And with Josh, it's like, why do you want to make this? And it's like, well, it's based on my real grandma, and it's about this, and it's about this thing I experienced with her. And there's so much kind of truth and honesty to it. And you know, when I was talking to Josh, it was like, that was very clear. And for me as a cinematographer, it's, I need to have that like why in my own life, you know, if I'm doing a film that I don't feel anything on the page and I'm not relating to it with things in my own life, it's like I don't know how to approach the visual language of it. So, you know, my grandma just turned 100, and we watched the movie together, and so many of the things, you know, I was at her little retirement home, and her friends would come in, and so much of the dialogue between them was like, oh, I was like, this is pretty much a line out of Thelma. So it was a really kind of relatable script, and, you know, my relationship with my grandma and how special that was growing up and still is today. And you know, the way that it kind of, it had a lot of empathy for older people and, you know, trying not to make fun of them, but trying to show them as real people with real hopes and dreams and people who haven't figured everything out, you know. It's really special.
Yeah. It's an incredible cast. The whole movie is put together so well. Josh, David, if you could talk a little bit just about the production of this, sort of like, you know, the nuts and the bolts, you know, you get the green light, you know, you're going forward. The money is found. How do you start putting this together? Is it a short shoot? How long did it take to make this? And what was the process like?
Well, we assembled a team of grandma's boys, and we now, but that, I mean, kind of, but you know, but true, I think by accident we kind of did. No, I think what was our shoot? Our shoot was 25 days. It was all here in LA.
25 days.
Mostly in the Valley. I think we shot, David and I shot like one day of like pickups, kind of just like running around, you know, getting little inserts and whatnot. But it's funny. I feel like we kind of shot listed the hell out of it. Like we went very methodically kind of through the whole thing and really tried to make sure we had a map in a way, because the movie is playing with, you know, kind of this family dramedy elements and also these kind of, you know, low key action genre elements. But I think what we also did, which, you know, and David obviously comes from also docs as well as narrative stuff. And I feel like we were very willing to throw stuff out when it felt overly complicated or fussy or needless. Like it's almost like, I feel like we did a lot of homework so that when we got to the shoot, if something was feeling, you know, off, we felt confident enough in knowing what every moment was that we could kind of adapt on the fly. Which I, as a process, found so, like, I don't know, it felt really natural and also really helpful, in terms of, you know, trying to kind of bring the thing to life, but also be in the kind of practical realities of given moments and trying to get out of the way sometimes of things that are happening when, you know, everything's on its feet. As you were saying earlier too, it's like, you know, on the page, everything is one thing. And then the second you're doing it, things change. Some things are how you thought they'd be. Other things kind of have a new feeling to them or work in the way you thought, or they don't. And so I think us doing a lot of homework and also being able to be kind of nimble with that was really helpful in, you know, shooting an indie in LA.
When you're also, I do come from a doc background, so it's like, I love experimenting on set and not being so rigid. So sometimes, you know, it's like, you want to have, but you want to be able to be like, ah, screw that shot, let's just do this other thing because the sun's setting, it's beautiful. But the logistics of it are challenging on this film, in the sense of it is a quick schedule, and B, you are with elderly actors. So, you know, as capable as June is and as amazing as she is, you don't want to do a bunch of takes on something and she walks from this side to this side and then you're like, yeah, this isn't working. June, let's actually do this over here instead. It's like, you know, if June's going to walk a far distance, we only want to do it once or twice.
We had certain ones that were one take. I feel like there were a couple shots, especially early in that process when we didn't want to, when we were kind of sussing out everybody's capacity, where, you know, it's like one take and that takes in the movie.
Yeah. It was physically demanding for her. So you want to be respectful of that. And you know, you want to come in prepared so that you're not just throwing June all over the place and running her through everything like crazy. It's like, you want to keep that stable.
I got to imagine you had a stunt double or body double for June at in moments in this project. Is it easy to find, older stunt women, stunt men? Is this a thing, or is it, I guess, I don't know. Is it just makeup effects, or tell me, was there a double employed in the making of this?
There. So Heidi Pasco doubled June in the movie, who's a wonderful stunt woman, that Ryan Sturz, our stunt coordinator, brought on. And, you know, it's funny, June ended up doing a lot more of her own stunts than we sort of anticipated, especially scooter stuff. We were, you know, I was pretty spooked by like the speed of that scooter when we first tried it out and the tippiness of it. And, you know, we had a close eye on that throughout the entire process, but Heidi was June's stunt double, and sometimes she would double for her, but also even when she wasn't, she would kind of be like running alongside her or, you know, coaching her through things or being very, very involved in the process with her. And Heidi is like, Heidi is not, you know, an older person, but we had, you know, some kind of prosthetics of sorts to kind of do what we could to sell the idea. But honestly, we kind of, that's why it was great that June was doing a lot, because there were certain things, you know, Heidi could do that we didn't have to hide. So like the little wheelie, you know, on the scooter, where it's like, June, we're not having June do that. And we don't need to like dress Heidi up so convincingly because it's just a shot from, you know, the down below. But we did find that like sometimes when you kind of tried to double her in full, like it didn't sell, especially in broad daylight as well as we hoped. And so we kind of tried to work around that quite a bit and use June wherever possible. And we were lucky that she was so game.
I think with that, you know, I've learned with action stuff, a lot of the time you can get away with doubles much easier when it's one of those fast cutting sequences where you're seeing them first flash and then it's the real actor. But this film was a lot more kind of long take. It wasn't quite as cutty. So if you're on someone for like 10 seconds and it's not June, I mean, June has a very specific way of walking like that. You know, as much as a stunt double can try and recreate that, it's like it's never going to be what June does exactly. It's a tricky thing to pull off. But it's funny how it mimicked the film in a way. Like, I think so much of this film was us being like, June, like, don't do that. Like, no. Yeah. Like, we'll get the double. And June being like, oh, shut up. Like, I'll do it. Like, you guys are a bunch of losers. Like, we've got to cover. We'd be like, no, June. And then she'd do it. And you're like, okay, why were we freaking out? Like, pre-production was pure, like, horror of all of us just being, like, anxious and nervous about how June's going to do this. And then, like, by day 25, we're like, June can fly off the cliff. Like, it'll be fine. Like,
yeah, you know, it did. Kind of it amazing. Really did mirror art imitated life and vice versa.
Yeah.
Well, let's take just a half step back. I know that, David, you made a movie called Some Kind of Heaven, and I'm curious how you guys connected. And I'm wondering, Josh, did you see Some Kind of Heaven? What was the connection point? How did you guys, you know, team up for this? Because, you know, David, your work's great. It's really, really great work. But when I'm thinking about putting this movie together, here's a guy who does a lot of documentaries, like tons of documentary work. And that's not the only thing you do. You've done other stuff as well. But of the laundry list of DPs, I'm just wondering how your name got to the top of the list, how you ended up getting this gig. How can you guys tell the story of how that
went? He should have hired Deacon, honestly. I don't know why he goes.
I can tell you why. I did see Some Kind of Heaven, and that became actually a huge touchstone, like a huge inspiration to me in terms of how I just love the movie. I think it's wonderful and was very inspiring. And the way it's shot is so, to me, was so like beautiful and cinematic and like filmic, but also kind of very intimate and natural. It had this really unique blend of like feeling really human and natural and also having this almost like fantastical, beautiful style to it. And the fact that those were both kind of sandwiched together in one was just something I couldn't stop thinking about. And in making this movie, it was so important to me to find, you know, a partner who kind of saw it the way I saw it and wanted to bring that kind of textured and filmic look to it and kind of bring it down to earth a little bit, but also be able to have fun with it. Because again, I think the premise, it can easily skew very broad. And so much of our work was trying to be like, let's make sure everything is born of kind of emotion and subjectivity and intention. And I just was really, you know, there's a long way of saying I was incredibly inspired by David's work. And we, you know, reached out and his agent, you know, to his reps, and we met and we kind of hit it off. And I think we've talked about it. It's like dating. You're like, you know, you go and you meet up and you're like, oh, okay, like, could I see myself with this person? Like, could this work out? And we had a couple more dates and we decided to give it a shot.
We're official.
We made it official.
It moved fast and now we're married. So, but it's interesting. I think documentaries have really influenced how I film narrative work. And I think so much of it for me is it's important for things not to feel overly lit or over the times. It's like I'm chasing that feeling of realism and that subjectivity that a documentary can bring. And I think that was always in our mind. It's like we didn't want this to feel like a SNL skit, because you know, the premise of it, I think a lot of people are like, okay, it's like an old woman action film, like this is kind of crazy. But even though it has a bit of a nutty premise, it's like we wanted it to feel real and we wanted people to empathize with Thelma and what she was going through. And if you don't have that emotional core to the film, it's just kind of a spoof movie. So it's like, it was important for us to always be with Thelma and be with her emotionally. And although we had those action tropes in it, it was very much centered kind of around June Squibb's face and her performance. So that was at the core for us.
Yeah. It's an amazing performance too. It really is great. I don't want to jinx it.
Amazing.
But I'm talking to people here and there who are saying that she really deserves some love from the community about this movie. So we're you know, I'm very much rooting for her and I'm very excited. So hey, I Going back into the whole idea of, you know, documentary versus narrative, because they're different muscles. Definitely different skill sets. Now, granted, shooting a camera, operating a camera, lighting a scene, there's a lot of stuff that carries over, and it's a lot of similarities. And there have been some really notable people who've started off in documentary and then moved into narrative. I'm thinking of like Pascal Wexler and Sean Bobbitt and a bunch of other people who's like, you know, documentary work and narrative work is brilliant. But is there, tell me, David, how do you readjust yourself or get into the mindset of going like, okay, the usual sort of stuff that I might do on a long form, long schedule documentary now have to change?
It's interesting for me because I think so much of my career has been like the process of making a documentary feel like a narrative film. And in my narrative work, making a narrative film feel a bit more like a documentary film. And it's funny how, because I'm kind of on those two extremes, it's like a part of my work kind of meets in the middle, where my documentary and my narrative work don't feel that different because both are kind of striving to become similar. But it's funny for me. I feel like I'm a very, I'm a vulnerable dude at my heart. I sets can often be quite stressful and quite isolating. And I've been on commercial sets where you feel like, oh my God, there's 200 people around and everyone's looking at the monitor. And this doesn't feel like I'm creating art right now. This feels like something else. And in documentary, it's really special because oftentimes you have four or five trusted people who are really close friends, and you can kind of feel free to push boundaries and no one's going to judge you. And I think that's the beauty of documentary. And with narrative film, I think so often it's about scaling back and trying to bring that intimacy into the set and not have it feel like this massive production. So for us, it was like building this really kind of like family oriented team where it was like, okay, the grip really cares about the film and it has a lot of input, and the production designer, we're really close with her, and the set just felt like a family. And we kind of tried to keep it small. And I think so much of that came from June and her energy, because she felt like all of our grandmothers on set. So it had this really cozy feel where like everyone on set kind of really cared about the film and really wanted to make it special. And was, you know, we weren't judging each other. There was none of that toxicity that you see on so many film sets. It was this kind of like universal mission to create something special. And it was because of June at the core of it. You know, we wanted to make it good for her and for the real Thelma. So the set was like special, like one of those sets that you rarely, rarely get where it's just like, wow, this is a family.
Yeah, I feel I got very spoiled by that. It was really, you know, I
when
can echo
it comes
echo
from it. Josh's curation, you know. So
well, it was, and I also agree with you about June, though. I think it's something about, you know, it's like if June's on good behavior, you can't be on bad behavior. Like this person is like giving this her all, and you know, yeah, having her 93rd birthday on set, like everybody kind of needed to rise to the occasion and meet her at her level of like, you know, professionalism and kindness and all of that. So I think, yeah, we, you know, I think in some ways too, kind of like what we were saying earlier, the people who were drawn to it and the people we were drawn to ended up kind of sharing that ethos, which I'm, you know, happy to hear and glad to know that the set felt that way. Cause that was, you know, the hope. It feels like making movies is hard enough. There's no reason to like needlessly add other insane stresses. Cause you know, even on a really smooth production, which this ostensibly was, like, you know, you're still trying to make your days. You're still, you know, there's many a challenge. And so it's nice to be going into it kind of bonded and with clarity of vision. And also to David's point, I think David was really smart about trying to keep things intimate and small whenever possible, which was something we tried to kind of, you know, follow wherever we could. Cause I my background is different, but just coming from like making things, making shorts, sketches, web series, whatever it might be, or other like super indie features, like, I don't know, all the sets I've been on, all the things I've made have been very like homegrown and kind of free flowing in that way. So I think we had some natural propensity to not want the set to feel really regimented and cold and, you know, put in place what we need to be safe and organized, but within that, have it feel, you know, as organic as we could.
Yeah, that's a difficult balance, especially in the indie film world. And I think that, you know, your AD staff really sort of set some tones too. And I think that you're finding your people is really kind of what it's all about. Now, I don't know the whole Sundance story. Did you have distribution going into Sundance already? Were you already? No. But Sundance was pretty, monumental for you then. So can you tell the story then of going through that process?
Yeah, no, it was, I feel a lot of huge, huge gratitude towards Sundance, because I do think that they really gave us the platform, you know, the movie needed to kind of find its path. We shot in the fall of 2022, and we wrapped like basically too close to get a cut together to submit for Sundance 2023. The timing just didn't work. So we ended up on kind of this like off schedule, so to speak, where we had kind of a long time for post. And I would say that was like a blessing and a curse, but 90% a blessing. I think at a certain point you can go a little stir crazy and be like, wait, what am I changing? Or like, why are we changing this? But I do think having time to go away and come back and continue to hone and tighten and sharpen was really, really a gift to the movie. So by the time we were submitting to Sundance, we had a lot of, you know, little screenings for people and gotten a chance to get all the elements kind of pretty fully developed. I didn't think we were going to get in. I was just like, I don't think it's going to happen. I just was feeling, you know,
optimistic,
like,
yeah,
I was like, wow, that would be amazing. But I don't know. It definitely felt like it was, you know, the exception to some of the things that end up there. And it's kind of being like, even just the comedy or the whatever, like it obviously was made with a lot of care and something that we wanted to do really artfully, but I just wasn't sure for some reason from where I was sitting. I was like, they're not going to want me. And then we submitted a pretty fully realized cut and tried to be as thoughtful in our application process as possible. Zoe Worth, our producer, had done some of the labs there. So I feel like she also had a really great sense of just like kind of the feeling there in the community and, you know, making sure we were framing the movie up in a thoughtful way. We found out, I got a call from someone, this guy, Adam Montgomery, saying, hey, can you call us back? You know, this is Sundance. We have a question about the movie. And I was like, oh God, like, what is this? What is this? What does this mean? And I called him back. I like pulled the car over and called him back. And I was like, hey, it's Josh. And he said, hey, I have we had a question about the movie. Actually, we had one question. Would you like to premiere it at the festival? And we were like, oh my God, yes, this is the best phone call we've ever gotten. And it was really, literally, we were so psyched. And then an hour later, it was like logistics. We were like, okay, we have to book hotels. We have to figure out June, you know, Zoe and Chris especially were like instantly into like, okay, there is snow, there is ice. How is June getting from A to B? It's like they went right back into production, which was kind of amazing to just see like that kind of thinking jump back in. But the festival, yeah, we were going in without distribution. We were, you know, hoping to find a partner there. And we felt really, really lucky that Magnolia was so enthusiastic about the movie. And I think more than anything also saw it the way we saw it. They saw it as like a movie centering older people, but for everyone. As opposed to a movie, you know, about older people, specifically geared toward older people. I think, of course, I want it to be for older people, but I almost felt like that went without saying because of the nature of it. But it was really important to me that it also made a story about somebody who maybe isn't always centered in sort of slightly more mainstream movies accessible to people, and something that people could plug into and see themselves in and see their grandparents in and see their family in. So I think they saw it as that kind of cool, fun, funny version of the movie, as opposed to the very niche version, which was how we always saw it. And they took that leap with us. And that was really, really invaluable. And yeah, they were amazing partners, but it was crazy. The first couple of days there were really a whirlwind. It was jam packed, but fun.
There was a lot of buzz coming out of the festival for this movie. That's when I first heard about it. And it was on the short list of things I really had to see. I usually do Sundance. I didn't go this year. And so when it came out, I was like, okay, Thelma, I got to see Thelma. People were talking about Thelma. And I'm curious now, you know, now that, you know, distribution and out in the theaters and then the buzz, it's still really buzzy now coming to VOD and streaming. your life change at all? Are people calling you up saying, we want to make Thelma 2. We want to make it a trilogy. We want to, what's going on? Like how has Thelma impacted your professional lives?
It's funny. It's like, in some ways, it's like in so many ways, it's both completely changed my professional life. And also in some ways, everything feels the same. It's like this funny mix of like people, you know, wanting to find projects to do together and, you know, having these opportunities to get work in front of these people who, you know, I never would have had the chance to do that before. And that's all been really, really wonderful and exciting. And then the other side of that coin is also, you know, I'm just sitting in my room trying to write, and that's kind of the same as it was before. So it's, at the end of the day, I would say it really has felt like a big change, and a change that I'm kind of catching up to and adjusting to and trying to figure out how to navigate. But I think there is still that almost reminder sometimes that amidst all, you know, those different bits of excitement and possibility, there is still kind of at the core of it, just like kind of putting blinders on sometimes and just doing the work and digging back in and trying to approach something from a place of passion and enthusiasm, as opposed to, you know, just a shiny object sometimes. So I'm trying to balance those things, but it's definitely been a really fun and lovely chapter of, you know, opportunity.
David, how about you?
Yeah. I mean, I think I've now completely pigeonholed myself into elderly film. So I only, people are like, you can't film young people. I can only film old. It is funny. Like I get sent a lot of like commercials and films about old people. It's like, I'm like, dang, I guess it's my niche now.
you did it too. No, well,
mean, yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I'm doing a commercial with elderly people next week, but, no, I mean, you know, it's always exciting. Like, you know, when you have a film come out like that and, you know, we were lucky that Thelma, it was like very overwhelming to see how well it did in theaters for an indie. Like, you know, that was really exciting. And like, I was honestly amazed by it, because you go into an indie film just hoping, you know, 1,000 people watch it, and, you know, it did really well at the box office, which was really encouraging. And certainly there's a slew of kind of energy as the film comes out and people calling you, and you get sent a lot of scripts, and that's awesome. And I think for me, it's always just been trying to slow down and be like, okay, this is exciting and you're getting bigger offers now, but at its core, you got to go back to, you know, that question I said at the beginning of like making sure a director's making a film for a reason and making sure that I'm not doing a project because it has a big budget, but I'm doing a project because it's something that I emotionally can invest in and give part of my soul to, because what's the point of making movies if they're just kind of, if it's a job or if it's just something for the money. So yeah, just trying to take a step back and say, okay, that's really awesome. This success has been awesome, but let's just focus on finding good scripts and good stories and directors who are like Josh and really care about the stories they're telling.
I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the care that's involved. I'm just going to briefly share a tiny story with you gentlemen, because I think that you'll appreciate it. Many years ago, a good friend of mine made a short film about his grandmother, called it Madre. It's great. It's about his, you know, his grandmother. And it's just sort of this nice little short vignette. I remember when he was going to take it out into the festival world, he went to a festival and met some people in person and said, hey, I made a film about my grandmother. And he said that the reaction was immediate skepticism when he said he made a movie about his grandmother, and that one of the people there who was very droll, smoking a cigarette, said, do you love your grandmother? And he said, well yes. And she said, okay, you can submit it. And it was like, this story comes back to me. It's made me think so much, because I have to imagine that as you're telling people about, you know, it's an action film with elderly people, that there might be skepticism, or there might be like, oh, this is going to be something that makes older generations look bad, or this is going to be something where the fact that their age is going to be played for laughs in a mean-spirited way, which is so far from the reality of this movie, where anything that's a laugh based on age, the entire cast, everyone in the story is in on the joke. It's all, everyone is so in, is so, look, I feel like First of all, just amazing cast. And I feel like I should mention Malcolm McDowell, even though he's a total surprise towards the end. Everyone's in on the joke. Everyone's in the same movie. You've seen movies, absolutely, where there are actors in that movie. They don't know what movie they're in. Not this one. Everyone is so in sync. So I guess what's all this is leading to is that where do you go next, Josh? Is your next, I know you don't want to get pigeonholed like David, but at the same time, what you created here is such a rarity. Is there some impulse inside of you to try to, you know, capture the magic again? Maybe not Thelma too, but are you trying to say like this is your feature directorial debut, your follow up here? It's like what are you thinking? What are you going to go 180 degrees? Is it going to be something totally out of left field?
Well, thank you for saying what you're saying about the movie. I really appreciate that. It's funny that a lot of what I'm doing is trying to kind of, in a way, separate myself from the result of this movie and try to get back in touch with the process of it, if that makes sense. Like, sure. Kind of removing some of the trappings of, okay, what's the genre, or what's the, you know, subject matter, and more, what's my feeling about the theme or the idea behind it? For me, it's like, I feel like I have a story to tell about my grandmother and my family and my relationship to her, but I certainly wouldn't want to say I am the authority on, you know, aging or people over, you know, X age. I feel like that would become sort of disingenuous. Not that I wouldn't tell another story or want to, you know, make a movie about people in that age range again, because, you know, my grandma is someone who is such a kind of inspirational figure to me. So never say never, but I also do feel like, yeah, I'm trying to get back to basics and figure out what is sort of sparking a similar level of excitement. What I can say right now is that I'm working on a survival movie right now. So different, but also, you know, something that I felt I had a take on and that I could really relate to in a very, you know, personal way, and sort of put through a lens that feels specific to me, while kind of, again, maybe playing on some tropes of the genre, so to speak. So I think if anything, that's kind of I'm wanting it to be something different, but also something that is kind of in some ways maybe an evolution from you know, the same thought. This is all a long-winded way of saying I hope it doesn't suck, and the pressure's on. So I'm gonna try to figure it out.
Well, and if I can say like something, I mean, Josh is, I think what makes Josh so special as a filmmaker, and you'd see it every single day on set, and everyone would, is that Josh has these like little details about life that you're like, wow, that is so real. Like, that is so relatable. And there's so many of them in Thelma, of like the little way Thelma does this thing or organizes a thing on her desk, or the way she walks, or her pushing her walker. He had all these little details that felt so honest and authentic. And I think that's lacking from so many movies. It really felt real and special and authentic. And it was something like everyone on set was just amazed with all the time. So I think Josh will do well again. He's amazing. He's an amazing filmmaker.
Hey, I'd like to hear, like, what was a particularly memorable experience, good or bad, in the process of getting this movie done? Because every movie has its, you know, its trials. It has its difficulties. And this story doesn't have to be that. But if you each have something like a day or a recollection from that's going to stick with you, something that you're going to carry with you, what would that be?
Well, I mean, I could speak from a cinematography nightmare perspective. we had a really, I mean, you know, we were still making this when COVID was still a bit of a concern. So, and obviously with June, we were all being so careful, like really careful, like extreme COVID protocol, which, you know, COVID had kind of chilled out a little bit, but just because of the nature of we're working with elderly people, we had to be really careful. And unfortunately a G&E member got exposed. Rightfully so, the producers made an amazing call, which at the time I thought was extreme, but in hindsight you're like, okay, thank goodness they made that call, that everyone on the electric side had to leave set. And this happened the morning of a shoot day. This was at the Mona's house, right?
Mona's house, yeah, exactly.
So you're like, okay, well, you know, there goes my lighting team. I guess I'm just doing this with natural light and grippage today. And you're like kind of trying to get a gaffer to run in. But this is really where you're like, okay, thank goodness, like I have a bit of documentary experience. And we were like, okay, well, I guess we're going to mold these scenes to what works for the natural light. So I remember, Josh, we did this phone call, the phone call scene where Thelma's grandson is like waking up and he's like, what happened? Like, where am I? And it was like, okay, well, we have no lights. So we're like, okay, well, let's put the bed right by the window. And the sun is kind of coming in at 10 a.m. So that'll be nice. And I guess we'll just put some haze in it and hopefully it looks okay.
It ended up looking great. That stuff ended up looking amazing.
Yeah, but you just, that's the things where you really got to adjust as a DP, because like, I have all these plans of a HMI on a scissor lift and all these things. And you kind of are just like, all right, well, in a documentary context, you know, I'm going to use a window and I'm going to make sure they're kind of half lit. So, you know, there were those nightmares for sure that were really frustrating and challenging. And, you know, all these grand schemes I have of lighting, and you kind of have to just be like, you know what, this is, we just got to work with it and adapt. So definitely there were some tough COVID situations.
That was a big one. Sure. Yeah, that was a big one. I had forgotten about that day. That was like a real curveball. Yeah. And
of course,
yeah,
I forgot about it. Yeah,
I know you had to carry all that burden. Yeah. Yeah. But that, I remember there was also a day when we were shooting on Halloween, and we were like, it was outside of that like PO box that they end up at where they're sitting on the bench, June and Richard. And there was like an active crime scene kind of unfolding like down the street, and there were helicopters, and we literally couldn't record the scene. We couldn't get sound for like the entirety of that shoot almost. And so we ended up having to kind of be like, okay, what's the version of this scene that like has, okay, how do we do the scene with no dialogue? Like, what's a version where they're just sitting, we get the information we need, and we'll do the silent version. A guy, you know, a director named Raymond DeFelita, who I'd worked for a long time, I think had told me once about how he would do the silent, I think it was what he would do, like the silent version of a scene. I forgot if it was a rehearsal tactic or something they would shoot sometimes of like, now let's shoot it with no dialogue, just to give ourselves this like, you know, this kind of purely visual version of a moment, if it could lend itself to it. And that just became kind of our quick fix. And then so luckily, and this, I was also a little bit shielded from this, because apparently the like police were saying like, hey, if, you know, things escalate, like, it's not, the situation is not contained, we're going to have to move you guys out. So things were, it was getting hairy, but luckily, finally, the crime ended in whatever capacity.
30 minutes before wrap.
Yep. And June and Richard did basically like a take of the scene, and they nailed it, and we got it. And that's in the movie. It was another one of those moments where like, we were really, it felt like it was like, this is, we're not going to get it. Like, there's just no way. And then at the last moment, they, you know, the audio kind of cleared out, and they were able to kind of, you know, just knock it out, which was another, I think, a gift of having actors who have kind of, you know, I remember Richard at one point saying like, I've done some action movies before. And I was like, I'm aware. And I think it was just a feeling of like, hey, I'm good. Like I've been through this. Like I know what this is like, and at a crazier scale than this.
I think the film gods were certainly smiling on you that day. You were getting that scene no matter what. So
I think so. Yeah. It certainly wasn't my doing. It was something was working for us that day. Spirit of Halloween.
All right. So gentlemen, we don't usually talk a ton about tech, although there are certain people out there who are always like, hey, ask about tech. Tell me about your camera and lens sort of package and how you went about creating the look of Thelma. I mean, David, I'll throw that to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, the look of something is really important to me. And I try and create a look that's really unique with the camera and the lensing, but it's also a practicality thing. You know, it's also, I'm making choices based on what's going to put me in a situation to win in the context of if we're moving fast or if we're in low light situations or whatever it might be. So, you know, we were really lucky that the Alexa 35 had like just come out. Which was like really exciting, but also really scary, because you know, as a DP, you kind of get used to it, and it's like, okay, I know how to make an Alexa Mini look good, but an Alexa 35 is a whole new color science, and how does it work with my LUTs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it took a lot of prep to kind of like figure out like, how do we make this color science work? And we developed like a new LUT that I thought really
Log C4, now your white point's lower. So, you know.
It was crazy. And it's not an easy conversion where you're just like, okay, we're just going to go take my Alexa mini LED and just easily convert it. It was like, I had to go to a lot of colors and figure all that out. But it wasn't really, you know, in terms of like picking a tool that's right for the job, the Alexa 35 was pretty crazy because you can shoot 6400 ISO and there's so much of this film that takes place at night. And if we go back to my philosophy of like keeping things intimate and keeping things small and keeping things moving, it's like my worst fear is like, okay, like I have a night scene with June and it's, we have to take 2.5 hours to flip around because this night exterior setup is massive. And now June's waiting in the cold. And it's like, that's my biggest nightmare. Like as a DP, I think we can all relate to like, that's what gives us nightmares and keeps us up at night. So the Alexa 35, it was like, okay, we can shoot at night and we can use kind of natural street light for a lot of this and just add a little bit to create a key light on her. But generally we can kind of capture the city naturally. So that was pretty cool. That was awesome.
An awesome
perk of that camera.
Yeah, for sure. My company sells the Alexa 35. So, you know, I'm a huge fan, regardless. It's sort of the undisputed king of cameras right now. If you have the budget, it's totally worth it. So anyway, well, gentlemen, I think that this has been a fantastic conversation and I'm really excited to see what you guys do next. But tell me, where can people find you? Do you do a social media thing of any sort? Do you have an Instagram? Can people follow you or something anywhere out there? What's a lot of people don't have that, but what do you guys got?
Josh is a big TikToker. So
are you a TikToker?
I'm not. I am addicted to TikTok, but I don't post. I have an Instagram. It's what is it? God, JMargo999. I made it so long ago. I might have made it something different.
Grandma's boy 6250.
Little grandma's boy 626. 310 granny lad.
Josh's Instagram is just a bunch of photos of Thelma. So, you know.
Yeah, at this point, it's basically shared posts with David and pictures of June or my real grandma. So if you're into that kind of thing, check it out. David's got a beautiful Insta, a lot more variety.
Yeah, my Instagram is David Bolin DP, very, very boringly. So,
In case anyone is listening to this and didn't write that down, it's going to be in the show notes over at camnoir.com. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show. This was so much fun. I really can't wait to see what you guys do next.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was Josh Margolin and David Bolin, the creative team of Thelma. Hey, thank you so much. It was really great having you on the show. I can't wait to see what you guys do next. You'll have to come on again. That was so much fun. Anyway, so Ben, guess what time? Guess what time it is right now?
Pacific Standard Time, it is 11 o'clock on the nose.
You're doing your old joke. It's time to pay the bills. It's time.
It is my old joke.
It's time to thank our fine friends over at Aperture, makers of all kinds of incredible lights. And I got to give them credit. They just totally revamped their website. Good for you, Aperture. Your new site is amazing. And it's so much easier to get around and to really kind of see the different stuff that you guys do. Awesome. I want to highlight a product that's been out for a little while, but that people should really not be sleeping on. It's the MT Pro. MT Pro is about a 1 foot tube light. It's RGB, it's pixel mappable, it's USB-C rechargeable, and it's got the Aperture Cytus Link, so you can control it with your phone and various apps and that sort of thing. It is really an incredible $199 little tiny light that it's easy to mount into baby pins and adapters and different sorts of things. MT Pro, I don't want to oversell it, but you know, tube lights have kind of been a thing for a while, but this is a great one to have in your kit. The battery lasts a long time, it's particularly bright, and it has all of these extra sort of like effects and things that you can do with it. So check out the MT Pro, check it out at Hot Rod Cameras. We keep them right on the front desk when people walk in, and I'll tell you, we sell them because I think people pick it up and go, what's this? And then
it's like an impulse buy. It's like chewing gum.
$199 is sometimes an impulse buy type product. It really is. I mean, so it's worth taking a look at. Find it at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Check out the Aperture MT Pro.
And now, short ends.
Ben, It is our short end time of the show. It's the time when we talk about our pet obsessions. Do you have a pet obsession this week? What are you all about?
Mine is social media related. And for reasons I don't really think anyone would be surprised about, I'm interested in kind of getting off of Twitter, a.k.a. X. I've been a big Twitter guy since like 2009 or 2008. I've been on Twitter for a long freaking time. And I've made a lot of good friends on Twitter. And, you know, I've often thought if I went through my entire Twitter feed, could I maybe get 5 minutes worth of stand-up comedy material out of the wise-ass things I say on Twitter? And yet, Twitter seems to be full of a bunch of toxic assholes lately. And
what? This is the first I've heard of this.
It's very surprising. No, I mean, I feel like I've been holding out for a long time. And I had signed up, I'd gotten in on the beta of Blue Sky, which I don't even know how they don't get sued by Twitter, because it's basically Twitter, and it was set up by Jack Dorsey originally, who was the founder of Twitter and was, I believe, the CEO of Twitter until Voldemort decided to take it over, right? Anyway, I've been on there, hadn't really been using it that much, but I've been kind of experimenting because I like the idea of microblogging, and I've actually made real, actual, in real life, met them for drinks, actual friends on these sites. And I actually got hired for a job once off of Twitter. So like, to me, like it's as real a place as any other place where you can meet people, you can meet collaborators, you can meet former employers. Not former employers, future employers.
Sure.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd gotten in on the beta of Blue Sky, and I hadn't been finding it to be super useful, although I noticed that the vibe of Blue Sky was very non-toxic. Like, if people started getting toxic and obnoxious, everyone just blocked them. Like, nobody was into people bloviating and being toxic jerks on there. I'm sure they're there. Like, you don't need to point to me to the toxic jerks. And if they aren't there, they're going to be there. But Blue Sky seems to have like better methods for content control for yourself so that you're not besieged by this kind of stuff, and tools in place to kind of help mitigate that. And so I decided, what if I start using Blue Sky? Because like for a long time, I would post something on Twitter and then maybe I would post it on Blue Sky. I was like, what if I reverse that? And also like do what you do when you start a new social networking app and just follow a bunch of people and participate, because that's the real key. Like, the people who fail at this stuff are people who are output only, who are like, here, let me talk about my, you know, like if you had a hot rod cameras thing that all it did was tell you about hot rod cameras, that would bum you out. But like, I'll use a really good example, Fade In, the screenwriting software. The official Fade In Twitter feed like interacts with people and talks to them, and it's run by a real human being. And I think that's all anyone wants. And I got on there, and I got to tell you, the level of engagement is awesome, and there are great people on there. And you'll find most of the people who you know on Twitter, or at least a lot of them, have moved. But then like, and this actually kind of gets me to the crux of my short end, which is I found an extension for Google Chrome called Sky Follower Bridge. If you go to skyfollowerbridge.com, and what it does is you log into your Twitter account and you log into your Blue Sky account, and it finds all the people that you follow on Twitter who are on Blue Sky. And then with one button, you can follow them on Blue Sky.
All right.
And it's like, oh, look, if you like Twitter, X, if you like that crap, I'm not casting any aspersions at you. Enjoy it. Go for it. And I'm not saying I'm even leaving it. I probably will leave my account open on the hopes that one day it gets sold to someone less horrible. But I think for the time being, I think that like what I liked about Twitter seems to be happening at Blue Sky, which is to say, exchange of ideas, people kind of friendly and easy to access, and not like a gazillion, you know, Russian bots and trolls and people who want to like, you know, curse at you and yell at you and say awful trollish things. And, you know, I usually, as soon as they pop up, I mute them anyway on Twitter, but I haven't even encountered, I encountered one on Blue Sky and muted, and that was fine. Anyway, so if that's the kind of thing you're into, check it out. I think I think it's definitely getting a lot more followers. And again, I don't know how Jack Dorsey didn't get sued, because it's just like Twitter. It must be some back end coding stuff that I literally don't even begin to understand how it works.
Wow. All right. Interesting. Blue sky it is. Okay.
Yeah. Check it out. So, Ilya, what is your pet obsession this week?
Well, it's another very timely one. This was actually just announced today, this morning. And I had just saw it actually before we started this podcast. And so I was very excited to share it here. So this is, there's a good chance that when our show goes live tomorrow, there's a lot of people who have not even heard of this yet. But Fujifilm has announced that they are officially developing their first filmmaking-centric camera, which they are calling the Fujifilm GFX Eterna. Now, 15 years ago, I had a meeting with some yuckity, you know, uppity-ups over at Fuji, and I told them, you guys should really be in this business. You guys don't seem to have a really clear strategy to go down this path, and it would make a lot of sense to me that you leverage your storied history in film, in particular film, you know, making color negative film, making film.
Well, like, does Fuji still make film? I thought they got out of it.
But this is 15 years ago. I was talking about this.
Yeah, so they're making a film camera today, but they don't make the film
anymore.
No, it is
their first filmmaking-centric camera. It is not film. It is a new camera. See, well, the cameras they've made right now are all still photographers, all still photographers-centric. There is some hybrid cameras which have the ability to shoot 4K and other high-resolution formats of motion. But they've always still been housed inside the very still camera focus. And the interesting thing about Fuji is they don't have what a lot of people out there consider sort of like the gold standard, which they would say is large format or full frame 35. Fuji has Super 35 size sensors, and larger than Super 35, they have essentially a medium format size sensor. So Fuji has announced that their new camera, they call the GFX Eterna, is essentially taking their very large 102 megapixel medium format sensor, or essentially their version of 65 millimeter, and building a cinema camera around it. So, which is exactly what I told them 15 years they should do, and they're finally getting to it now, which I think is wonderful.
So really, your short end is how smart you were 15 years ago.
No, they had done it 15 years ago, clearly. Look, I don't know if this camera is going to be a success.
Wait, so I don't understand. So is this larger than full frame?
Yes, it's like their version of 65.
So everyone get ready to learn new crop factors for this camera.
Yes, it's 1.7 times larger than full frame 35. Okay. And now, granted, that sensor has never been perfect, but it does have a much higher readout speed than their previous version of it. It is currently a sensor that's in another camera. And it is, you can go see, I think, a mock-up of this at Interbee, which starts tomorrow. If you're hearing the sound of my voice, it starts this, well, Japan's a day ahead, so it'll already be there. But supposedly, there's a couple of images. We've got a press release. Like, we can link the press release in the show notes from Fuji. It looks very sort of like Sony Red sort of looking camera body. It looks like it's got a pretty straightforward sort of interface. And the Fuji camera, the GFX Eterna, I don't know how I feel about that name yet either, but it could certainly be worse. It's not like the X7G5134, which, like,
yeah.
Anyway, which is what some other companies kind of do for some of their cameras. But
I mean, people will just say, I'm shooting it on the Eterna. No one's going to be like, I'm shooting this on the GFX Eterna.
I think you're right.
So, yeah, I mean, like, this is a very niche product for serious cinema people. And I would personally, I've never been against being an early adopter, but I would be afraid to be like, hey, I'm going to make my movie on this camera that just came out just now without significant testing. But at the same time, you know, it's not Fuji. This is not a new thing for Fuji to be doing.
They make really good stuff too, and they make really good lenses. Yeah. And I'm very enthusiastic about this. It wouldn't be my short end if I wasn't enthusiastic about this. I actually appreciate.
Oh, I do short ends about stuff that I hate all the time. Go on.
Well, not this one. I really hope that this goes well. I'm very much rooting for it. It's something that I think they frankly should have done 15 years ago, but the fact that they're doing it now,
as you've said,
I know, I really, look, I was like, there's an opportunity.
I'm telling you, your short end is yourself. You were right. 15
years ago. I also told Leica they should do it, and Leica didn't listen to me, so that's fine. So
Well, maybe they'll be eating some crow when you announce the new Leica camera next year.
I don't know if Leica is going to do that, but
the lycanthrope. We're calling it now. It's a werewolf camera.
All right, Ben. I think that just about does it for this show. Where can people find you if they want to find you outside of the Cinematography Podcast?
Please find me at benrock.com.
Find you at Blue Sky.
Oh, that's true. You can find me at Blue Sky at Neptune Salad at Blue Sky. But yeah, and I can't actually link to Blue Sky on my website yet because they don't have that link set up. But yeah, you can find me at benrock.com. Check out my reel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do follow me on Blue Sky. I'll follow you back. Mention you heard this. Hey, what do you know? We could create a group on Blue Sky for the Cinematography Podcast, and you could all tell me what an idiot I am. I can take it. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find
me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. I'm also on LinkedIn and Instagram. Those things seem to be the way that people reach out to me. So find me at one of these places if you'd like to find me. Talk about building a studio. Talk to me about upgrading your gear. We're doing some studio builds for people, which is exciting stuff.
Talk about buying an awesome $200 aperture light.
Awesome $200 aperture light. Or maybe a new Fuji camera that should be released sometime in 2025, they said. So
it is going to cost like a little more than
$200. I have no idea what it's going to cost. They haven't said. I think that'll be, I'm not sure they even know yet, but it'll be.
How much would it screw up the whole world if they're like $5,000?
They're not going to do that because their still photo version of that is $10,000, basically, more or less. So yeah, it's probably going to be north of whatever the GFX 100-2 camera is right now. So I'm not sure exactly what that's going to be, but it'll be something anyway. So Ben, sweet. Let's thank some people. Who do we have to thank for making this show possible?
The poor Michael Dispenza, who, as you're listening to this, is probably putting bandages on his fingers from all the editing he had to do in this episode.
Sorry about the camera overheating, Michael. That just sucked. And of course, now that I've got the fan on it, it has not overheated once. So anyway,
makes all the difference in the freaking world. So we also
figure this out.
We also got to thank Alana Cody, our producer, who's setting up some awesome interviews. We've done several of them already. We got some coming up because we're in Oscar season, baby, and we're going to be talking to a lot of really awesome people. Very exciting stuff. We also got to thank our composer, Kays Alatracci, who composed all the music that you've heard on this podcast. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Hire him to score a movie or in anything. He's great. And he does lots of other stuff too. Apparently I'm going to be in his short film that he's making. He asked me to be in, and I'm like, dude, I'm not an actor. And he's like, all you have to do is like grip your head and then your head's going to explode. I'm like, I'm going to watch my head explode. I'll totally do that.
He knew exactly how to get you in his movie. He suckered you in. He knew yeah, the words.
He used the Scanner's gambit. You know, if you want me in your thing, Cronenberg me. Anyway, Ilya, you want to take us
Thanks
out?
Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.